Campus FM presents a talk organized by the JMER in collaboration with the Department of Youth and Community Studies entitled The Slogan of Evidence-Based Policy, Practice, Education in Canada, Whom Does It Serve? This talk was delivered by Professor John Portelli from the University of Toronto in Canada.
On behalf of the Editorial Board of JMER, Journal of Maltese Education Research, and on behalf of the Department of Youth and Community Studies, I welcome you to this talk in the JMER Talk series. Today's focus is evidence-based policy, as with other concepts in education. Obviously, I'm not the main speaker, so I will not take time. But I would like to share with you a few points with regard to evidence-based policy, which will provide you with a springboard to Professor Portelli's talk. Professor Portelli has already described evidence-based policy as a trendy policy, as a policy very much fashionable and in vogue. And as with many other concepts which are fashionable, many tend to jump on the bandwagon uncritically. This evening, our aim, our mission is not to debunk or rubbish evidence-based policy, but at least to engage critically with the concept. That is basically our mission. As I said, I'm not the main speaker. However, I would like to share with you a few principles. First of all, the origins of evidence-based policy. As with many concepts, frameworks, paradigms, and metaphors in education, our evidence-based policy is not indigenous to education, it's an import. And this time around, the concept is an import from, is a direct import from the medical world, from the world of healthcare. And obviously, because it is an import from the medical world, it comes with a baggage. And the baggage is essentially pathological in nature. And I'm sure that Professor Portelli will dwell on this limitation as far as direct import to education is concerned. Second aspect that we have to keep in mind is the fact that as a movement, originally, evidence-based policy started as an essentially empiricist and a positivist movement. It is, in fact, expert-driven. And again, because it is positivist in nature, people who subscribe to positivism and empiricism know that they are subscribing to a particular milieu, a baggage with a number of values, the value of professionalism, for example, as performativity, the value of teachers as essentially technicists, the idea that statistical analysis is the best possible and credible evidence based. So this is another baggage that is brought into the fore with evidence-based policy in education. Another issue is the assumption, it's a very important assumption as far as evidence-based policy is concerned, but it is also as dangerous as it is important. And this is the assumption that evidence generated through research should directly influence policy. Now, we all, okay, practice in education, we all practice at different levels, and we know that between policy enactment, and obviously research, there are lots of layers, which are obviously sites of struggle. The layer of economics, the layer of political expediency, etc. So to link directly and to assume that there is a direct line and there is an intimate link between evidence generated by evidence-based research and policy and policy enactment, I think that is a very dangerous, okay, and daring assumption indeed. There is also the issue of linearity. Because this evidence-based policy is coming from medicine, there is this assumption that everything is linear. For us practitioners in education, we know that education is much more chaotic than linear. Chaotic, obviously, from the philosophical point of view. So this is another daring assumption that comes with evidence-based policy. Finally, because evidence-based policy is essentially positivist in nature, unfortunately, social critique tends to be marginalized. And this is also another problem with evidence-based policy, and I'm sure Professor Portelli will dwell on this issue of the marginalization of social critique in evidence-based policy at length. With that point, I am honored and privileged to introduce you to my dear friend and colleague, Professor John Portelli. John is a citizen of the world, but legally at least, he's both Maltese and Canadian. He's based in Toronto. He teaches at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, which originally was affiliated with, it was semi-autonomous, now it's fully integrated within the University of Toronto. He's a philosopher by training. At the moment, he's a professor, full professor, and co-director of the Center for Leadership and Diversity. He's also vice chair of his department. John.
Thank you very much, Carmel, and thank you for both of the departments or faculties for inviting me to give this talk. And also thank you for all of you who attended. It is nice to see some familiar faces, some of which I haven't seen for a long time. A good surprise. Carmel gave a very clear and succinct background to the issue that I will be dealing with today. The title, I end the title with a question, whom does it serve? I hope it gives the message that I will be seriously interrogating the movement of evidence-based policy and so on. However, I will try to be as fair as I can in giving an accurate account of the movement and also some hopefully fair and reasonable critiques. This paper is co-authored with a former doctoral student of ours, Riyadh, who is now a postdoctoral fellow in Iowa State University. It's a work in progress. The paper is about 50 pages. I won't read the entire paper, so I'll do a sort of summary of it. I will talk to some parts and read some other parts. We have done a very thorough literature search on evidence-based research, especially in relation to Canadian authors and Canadian contexts. We have over 150 items, including web pages, school boards, and so on. All right. It is also a reflection, so to speak, on the kind of work I have done in the last 15 years. Although my training and my preparation was in philosophy of education, and I still teach in philosophy of education. I also teach in the educational leadership program, and I try to bridge between the two. And as a result, I've been involved in several national empirical projects in Canada, and definitely the phrase evidence-based policy, practice, education, and so on is encountered very frequently in these studies. My aim is not to argue against evidence or empirical data, but to show the limitations of the movement itself. Here's the structure of the paper. We talk about how we became interested in this topic, the aim of the paper, our theoretical stance, and then something about the general context of EBE, for short. Carmel has referred a bit to that context, the qualities of EBE, and then the majority of the paper focuses on the Canadian examples and critiques, and then some concluding remarks. The French poet Paul Valéry wrote, "There is no theory that is not a fragment carefully preserved of some autobiography." Both Riyadh and I take this quote very seriously, and this is why we want to locate ourselves very clearly. In the case of Riyadh's background is in medicine. He has 2 degrees in medical sciences and then came to do a PhD in adult education at OISE. I won't talk about how he got involved in evidence-based research. He has his own stories. In my case, as I said, I have encountered the phrase evidence-based research, policy, and so on in relation to the national projects that I have been involved in, one on student engagement, one on students at risk, and other ones as well on alternative assessments. But the major turning point for me was an incident that happened to me in 2001. In 2001, the Progressive Conservative government of Ontario of the time introduced a new policy entitled the Ontario Teacher Qualifying Test, whereby all teacher candidates who had finished a BED or its equivalent before being certified to teach had to take a standardized pen and pencil test, paper and pencil test. Notwithstanding the critiques of such a test and the evidence showing the problems which started test, the Ministry of Education in Ontario still proceeded with the implementation of this test. A colleague of mine and I wrote a lengthy memo to the dean of our faculty at that time, Michael Fallon, and to the associate deans, outlining the problems with the implementation of such a test, identifying all the evidence through the literature searches that we had done, and urging the dean and the associate deans to actually take a public stance as a faculty vis-à-vis the problems of this test. We never heard a reply from the deans. However, 2 days later, the associate deans and the deans, the administrative dean of the faculty, organized a public policy seminar dealing on the Ontario Teacher Qualifying Test. Needless to say, my colleague and I attended. It was very well attended. About 90 faculty members attended this seminar where we had to openly discuss the OTQT. In this seminar, both my colleague and I made our stance very clear, identified the problems with the OTQT, and identified the literature support identifying the problems with the OTQT. Well, there were two main critiques or stumbling blocks or problems that the administration, not our colleagues, but the administration brought. One was that what we were presenting, they claimed, was not evidence-based, and therefore our proposal could not go ahead because it wasn't evidence-based, without, of course, clarifying what evidence-based means. Secondly, we were reminded that as intellectuals, as professors, we were not supposed to express political views, especially through our own profession, in my case, as a professor of education. We, of course, rebutted those claims, and a discussion ensued about what evidence means and so on. That went nowhere. We also critiqued the administration that by not taking a public stance, they were actually reproducing the very inequities of the policy itself, although they claimed that in principle they didn't agree with it. But they kept on saying, we have no direct evidence about the problems with OTQT because this is the first time that it's going to be implemented in Ontario. And secondly, we should not be taking political stances in public as a faculty. Now, this was 2001, the same year where the university made very strong political public statements about 9/11, but they couldn't see this contradiction, right? So this seminar didn't go anywhere as far as we are concerned, and we were told we needed evidence. And this is, well, there were other follow-ups. Together with two other colleagues, we did a massive study surveying the first group of thousands and thousands of students who took this test, 6,000 of them. And, of course, the responses massively showed us the problems that were found in such a test. The interesting thing is that less than a year and a half after we tried to stop the OTQT, there was a change of government. The Liberals were elected. And the administration, the same people, wrote a report entitled The Schools We Need. And in the report, The Schools We Need, they argued that we need to stop the OTQT because evidence massively shows us that there are problems with the OTQT. The interesting thing is all the references they quoted were exactly the ones that my colleague and I referred to in the memo. I'm locating this within my own experience. I cannot deny that my interest in doing this thorough research on evidence-based research in Canada arose from this personal experience of mine, okay? So I want to clearly make my location clearly. Some will say my bias. Well, then we'll get into another discussion. So the aim is to look at the nature of EBE within Canada in other contexts and then to ask the question whether the Canadian context is susceptible to critiques of evidence-based education generally. The problem with evidence-based is that it is a slogan, and slogans can be very helpful. The word slogan is derived from the Gaelic word, which means a call to arms. We do at times need a call to arms, but the question becomes sometimes that we act without actually reflecting and thinking about what is urging us to act. And this is why the need to reflect on the slogan evidence-based. The theoretical stance that Riyad and I take is what we refer to as a critical democratic framework, one which focuses on democracy as a way of life and participatory rather than simply a form of governance. It focuses on both procedural and substantive issues. The problem with the administrators in my own institution were that they were focusing exclusively on procedural matters, for example, rather than also substantive issues when we came to critique the OTQT. And informed action rather than simply spectator citizens by asking questions, of course, in whose interest, from whose perspective, who is marginalized and who is privileged. Our belief that there are no neutral contexts or contexts are theoretically and ideologically based. Even those who claim to be neutral, that itself is in itself an ideological base. And the claims of my own administrators and the report they published later shows how even their neutrality was in fact very ideologically based, right? They were afraid to take such a stance essentially because they did not want to have a confrontation with the PC government. When the Liberals came in, well, they were buddies with the Liberals, and the Liberals had been critiquing the OTQT, hence, all of a sudden, the evidence is available, and they're no longer neutral, and the question of being political is pushed aside, right? The role of theory is not to offer quick-fix solutions, and Carmel has referred to this, but the role of theory is to raise critical awareness, develop intelligent and responsible stances and actions, which is usually referred to as praxis. All right. In a nutshell, I have another paper on a robust notion of critical democracy, and I have been purposely using the phrase robust critical democracy to tease people, because, of course, the word democracy itself has become another slogan. I mean, who would dare not argue for democracy in 2008? But the question becomes what qualities we associate with a democracy. There are many popular views who, in my view, are anti-critical democracy, and hence, in my mind, would not really subscribe to a robust notion of democracy. The qualities on the left-hand side would be associated with the popular views of democracy. The qualities associated on the right-hand side would be associated with a robust notion of democracy. So equity rather than equality. Equity doesn't mean sameness. Variety of standards rather than standardization. Focusing on the public rather than simply the private. Focusing on agonism rather than antagonism, as was the case, I must say, with my administrators, focusing on substantive controversial issues rather than simply procedural matters, yes, discussing, but moving beyond discussing to social activism, and, of course, taking a stance rather than hiding under the umbrella of neutrality. We could discuss each of these, but that would be another paper. Associated, of course, with the popular notion of democracy is a traditional conception of theory. I think Carmel has referred to this as well. The rigid dichotomy between theory and practice, the one-to-one correspondence between theory and practice. The aim of theory traditionally is to predict and control and to universalize irrespective of context. And then the aim of people like myself and Carmel and so on would be to prescribe very directly and straightforwardly to people in the field what they ought to be doing. And of course, to the minute details, this is problematic from my perspective. The critical conception of theory looks at the interchange between theory and practice, is not afraid to deal with critical political issues, which are in the intermingling between theory and practice itself, and the aim is to develop intelligent and responsible decisions and actions, even at times, of course, when this is very risky, and to focus on the difference in context that need to be taken into account, and then, of course, to remind us on human agency and creativity rather than the fatalism associated with the old-fashioned notion of the relationship between theory and practice. So, in other words, the theoretical framework I am arguing for is that ultimately we need to act. That is not denied. Our actions are based on our decisions, and our decisions need to be based on our beliefs, whatever those may be, whether with regard to the nature of human beings, politics, religion, language, the world, and so on, and, of course, our understanding of the context. It seems to us doing otherwise would be really prejudging our own experiences. Now, if we are concerned as Democrats about prejudging people, then, of course, we need to be careful on what basis we interpret the context in which we are working. This pattern needs to be followed if we really are serious about not falling into the trap of prejudging. And, of course, there are implications, as Carmel mentioned, from this perspective, with regard to how professionalism is viewed. All right, so much for the theoretical stance. I will now focus a bit on the general qualities of evidence-based education. As Carmen mentioned, this is a worldwide movement. There are different terms that are used. I'm using EBE, in short, for evidence-based education, but in the literature you will find terms like evidence-based practice, evidence-based policy, evidence-informed practice, evidence-based research, and practice-based evidence. Notwithstanding the use of different phrases and the focus on different aspects, we observe a common focus in the work of proponents, namely the overemphasis on evidence and the promotion of the culture of evidence in education. This common emphasis is a major aim of EBE. Some proponents of EBE have identified more specific objectives. For example, according to Davies, the objective of evidence-based education is to ensure that future research on education meets the criteria of scientific validity, high quality, and practical relevance that is sometimes lacking in existence evidence on educational activities, processes, and outcomes. The issue, of course, becomes, and this is hardly ever clarified, what notion of evidence and what notion of validity and what notion of high standard of research. I am not against evidence. I am not against high standards. But the question becomes, whose standards and which standards determine what amounts to high quality research? The movement started in as a result of the slide is showing a movement towards greater accountability. We saw this in the UK, we've seen this in the US, and we've seen this in Canada as well. Again, here one needs to note, I'm not against accountability, but it depends what notion of accountability. There is a distinction that needs to be made between a narrow notion of accountability and moral responsibility. I'm more interested in moral responsibility rather than a narrow notion of accountability. A narrow notion of accountability leads us to simply accounting what we do without ever really evaluating the nature of what we have done. Some authors trace the evidence movement to the formation of the Cochrane Collaboration in 1993 and the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine in Oxford in 1995. There is no doubt, as Carmel said, this is an import from the medical field. And in 2000, the same move was found in the University of Pennsylvania. All right. Authors who support EBE claim that, you know, there is a crisis in the legitimization of educational research. Some claim that the research done in education is not of high standard. So this then the issue becomes, if the research is not of high standard, EBE is proposed as an alternative. Davies and others offer three reasons for the EBE, the rise in organizations seeking to advise or influence governments on their actions, the increase of public and political scrutiny, and the skepticism towards the field, and the increase in research on decision-making, particularly in medicine. But again, the question becomes, what kind of research? All right. Now, in a nutshell, when we review the literature on EBE internationally, these are the qualities we find. There are different terms used. I spoke about that. Evidence associated with the empirical realm, more specifically, with a narrow notion of science, And here we get into the issue of the distinction between scientism and scientific inquiry. There is no unpacking of the notion of evidence. It is assumed that the normal concept of evidence is the narrow scientific notion of evidence. And there is an emphasis on what works, best practices, effectiveness, efficiency, and there is no unpacking of these terms. Of course, who would want to argue against what works, best practices, and so on? But the problem is these are relational terms, and unless you really identify the aims in relation to best practices, effectiveness, and efficiency, these terms simply become empty terms. More qualities of EBE, the dichotomy between theory and practice, the narrow conception of science and experimentalism, the positivist notion of theory, linear causal relationship between theory and practice, and, of course, a whole set of neoliberal values and assumptions, values like reductionism, fragmentation, competition, marketization, and so on. Now, I will give you, I hope, yes, here are some quotes to support our general qualities of EBE. Robert Slevin, major U.S. proponent of EBE, educators and policymakers legitimately ask, if we implement program X instead of program Y, or instead of our current program, what will be the likely outcomes for children? For questions posed in this way, there are few alternatives to well-designed experiments. You can see the focus and the assumptions of the linear between X and Y. Hospitals, he writes, might be held accountable for their success rates with various conditions, but they would never dream of implementing procedures discordant with rigorous, widely accepted research. Similarly, schools should be expected to use methods known to be effective in general, and then to make certain that in their particular school, implementation of those methods is of sufficient quality to ensure progress on the state assessments. Again, the one-to-one relationship between theory and practice. Hargreaves from the UK, research should provide decisive and conclusive evidence that if teachers do X rather than Y in the professional practice, there will be a significant and enduring improvement in outcome. I mean, this is almost impossible. Those of us who have taught know that it is impossible to really identify conclusive evidence that if you do X rather than Y, there will be significant and enduring. I mean, the EBE is promoting an aim which is impossible to achieve. Teaching theory to professionals is dangerous unless it is accompanied by a sound body of empirical evidence closely related to their routine practices. Of course, the question becomes, which empirical evidence and what kind of empirical evidence? Dunn, Strivet, and Katzbeck, the extent to which the same or similar intervention characteristics are related to the same or similar consequences when the relationship is empirically established and is scientifically defensible is what makes the intervention evidence-based. Again, you see the process of standardization very clear in this quote. And, of course, Fuhr and others, accumulation of anecdotes masquerade as evidence. And this becomes very clear. Therefore, what amounts to empirical evidence? And I've worked with the field in Canada since 1982. And of course, when you work with the field, you accumulate anecdotes, right? Teachers accumulate anecdotes. Teachers doing action research accumulate anecdotes. According to the EBD tradition, of course, anecdotes masquerade as evidence. So the question becomes now, whose evidence counts? Who is marginalized by the assumptions and the nature of evidence as promoted by EBE? The critiques we find in the literature include the following. The comparison between medicine and education is problematic, and Carmel has referred to that earlier. EBE is another form of surveillance and control of what is going on in education, a reflection of the new kind of managerialism. It reflects neoliberal discourse and values. And narrow definitions of science and experimentalism based on logical positivist epistemology are problematic. EBE assumes neutrality and a narrow and exclusionary notion of evidence. EBE assumes a rigid distinction between theory and practice, narrow and prescriptive view of theory. All right. Now we come to the Canadian context, and here I think I will read to make sure I'm not misquoted, right? Throughout the Canadian literature and media, we find the use of different terms to operationalize EBE and the urgency, inevitability, and relevance of evidence-based education. Yes, the most commonly used term in the Canadian literature is evidence-based decision making. Many authors argue for the urgency of a move towards EBE in Canada. For instance, Charles Pascal, and now you have the quote on the screen, argues for the relevance of EBE for a what works agenda. He states it is now time for the provincial government to act to ensure that educational policy in Ontario is informed by evidence about what works and what does not. Levin, on the other hand, names the urgency of EBE, the desire to make empirical evidence more salient to government action in education is longstanding. However, the growth of interest in recent years in evidence-based decision-making has brought new attention to this issue. Right. And moreover, Earle further echoes the urgency of the EBE in the Canadian context when she writes, over the past few decades, the urgency to attend data in education has increased dramatically. There was a time when only evidence required for making decisions in schools was the best judgment of the principal. That time has long passed. The interest in data for decision-making comes in part from a culture that is awash in data. Of course, Earle is also making the assumptions that people in the field, like principals, don't make best judgments, right? And we know those of us who work in the field, we are constantly encountered with dilemmas which require that we make best judgments within the context in which we are working. I mean, there is the tendency in this quote also to assume that, again, policies ought to tell practitioners, including heads and so on, exactly what to do. Beyond the urgency aspect, other Canadian proponents assume the worth and inevitability of EBE. For instance, in a recent editorial, Glaze, Ben Jaffar, and Ross. Now, you need to know, by the way, Ben Levin is a colleague of mine, but he was also Deputy Minister of the Ministry of Education, and Lorna Earle was the head of the EQAO, which is the organization that takes care of all the standardized testing in the province of Ontario. And these things don't happen by accident, right? And Avis Glaze, who is a black educator, was head of the literacy and numeracy program, and now, ironically, she is the advisor to the minister on equity issues. And she writes, one of the most promising trends in education today is the focus on evidence-based decision-making. For a long time, stories of success were not rooted in recorded evidence. Today, discussions about data, evidence-based inquiry, and assessment of and for learning are the norm among classroom teachers. In this editorial, EBE is normalized and attributed as part of the schooling process. Moreover, it is evident from the quote that recorded evidence is privileged over other forms of evidence, which implies that evidence is primarily conceived as a systematic and formalized endeavor. The reasons for the importance, inevitability, and urgency of EBE identified by some Canadian authors are a reflection of a neoliberal climate. Neoliberalism is both an economic and political ideology that focuses on the maximization of market economy, profit, commodification, and instrumentalism, reduction of communal and governmental intervention, emphasis on the individual choice, the assumption of neutrality, meritocracy and equality, reductionism, efficiency, effectiveness, and accountability as ends in themselves, an attitude of adjusting or accepting the present conditions rather than attempting to transform the world, the privileging of narrow and logical positivist conceptions of science and evidence. More quotes. Some of these neoliberal elements are apparent in the following quote from a federal policy document. Now, this is not a provincial, it's a federal, Canada-wide. Evidence for learning policy is of critical importance for Canada at this time. The knowledge-based economy relies on the use of ideas rather than transformation of raw materials or the use of cheap labor. The knowledge economy requires a learning system that creates, acquires, transmits, and uses knowledge more effectively across individuals, enterprises, organizations, and communities for both social and economic returns for individual Canadians and Canadian society. using terms such as knowledge-based economy, economic returns, and the centrality of ideas as a new commodity are used in this instance to stress the economic and national importance and relevance of EBE in Canada. A justification that heavily relies on the commodification of knowledge, market economy, and instrumentalism. Moreover, the reference to Canada and Canadians bolster an essentialist nationalist discourse that assumes homogeneity of values and needs. And those of you who may have visited or lived in Canada know that this is a myth. There isn't a unifying Canadian quality or a unifying Canadian values. The discourse of effectiveness of knowledge production and application in learning systems and schooling process is also used to justify the need for EBE. Earl and Fallon write, "There is not enough time for adaptation by trial and error or for experimentation with fads that inevitably lose their appeal. In the knowledge society, the sharing of data and information has become a critical part of decision-making. Very few institutions function without relying on data. Although the societal process of sharing information and using it to produce knowledge is still not well understood, educators are recognizing that they need to use data. Research studies, evaluations, and routine data analysis offer mechanisms for streamlining and focusing planning and actions in schools." In this quote, there is a close connection, perhaps even an equation, between knowledge and data. However, there is no explicit indication of the kind of data referred to, nor is there a questioning of the ethical use of this knowledge. The primary focus is on decision-making and acting effectively in a timely, efficient manner without considering who may be marginalized and privileged by these decisions and actions. The interest of EBE is not only apparent in the literature, but is also visible in the electronic media. As an example here, we offer an example from a school board. A big school board in Hamilton, west of Toronto, in their mission statement, "Through our commitment to the role of evidence-based practice in the improvement of student achievement, EBEST will coordinate and facilitate research activities within the Hamilton Wentworth District School Board, develop partnerships with community researchers, and support best practices by collecting and disseminating evidence-based information." So the assumption is that the school board can collect all the evidence in support of best practices, which will then be given to the teachers to implement and no questions asked. "Our vision is EBEST will be an accessible and relevant support service that models high standards for research excellence." Of course, we don't know what they mean by high standards, right? "It will foster a climate that inspires members of the school board community to become more confident consumers and facilitators of research." So now we consume research, right? Rather than doing research as teachers, we have to consume it, using evidence to inform daily practice. Another quality we find in the literature, I hope this is it, is the centralization of the data. This is a problem as well. Once the data is centralized, then there is the whole issue of to whom it is accessible, right? Recently, I had two graduate students, Edward and Zainab, who needed some primary sources of a policy regarding foreign schools throughout the world who adopt the Ontario curriculum. They do this, of course, they have to apply, they are accredited, and they pay a fee, and then they are allowed to implement the Ontario curriculum abroad. And I wanted to analyze the policy. They researched for a month, and they were unable to get this policy. Although all the policies are centralized in the Ministry of Education. They went to the Ministry of Education to get the documents, and when you go to the Ministry of Education in Toronto, which is located in Toronto, and this may be a surprise to you people, since 9/11, this is the reason they were given, in order to speak to an officer from the Ministry of Education, you speak through a glass window, through a microphone, you press a button, you ask a question, and so on. And this, I mean, but this is exactly what the centralization of data does, right? And until today, they were still unable to get this policy, which directs implementation of the Ontario curriculum to foreign schools. And a very simple example, banal in a way, but it makes the point. I mean, this whole issue of centralizing centralization of data. Then the question becomes to whom it is available and what is done with the data. Okay, we found among other Canadian proponents, like the eBest website, the prevalence of a quality of EBE, the emphasis on what works agenda, effectiveness and efficiency. And here is another quote to demonstrate that. Very little is known in a systematic way about what works in education. We do not have good quantitative information about what makes schools successful or whether tax dollars for education are being well spent. As if all that research that has been done and all the knowledge that has been accumulated through experience and practice by teachers amounts to naught, right? One of the problems we face is the lack of agreement of across stakeholders groups about how to quantify excellence in education. But why do we have to have agreement on the aims? Education and values are contested issues, right? But the assumption here is that we have to have one standardized notion of excellence. Which variables should be included in analysis of school success or failure? The thesis of this paper is that studies such as the Third International Mathematics and Science Studies have made and will continue to make a unique and important contribution to the development of our understanding of what works in education. Some more examples, and there are hundreds of examples, but I wanted to give you a variety of examples to support our claims of the quality of EBE in Canada, or else someone will claim that I have no evidence to make my point. Canadian context. Here is again from Ben Levin. He writes, promoting the use of evidence-informed policy and practice in education reflects the government's commitment to improve student outcomes. To that end, the research strategy will guide the work of the ministry as we work to enhance access to research findings and promote the value of research in informing policy directions and classroom practice. Of course, here the issue is what notion of student outcomes is used. Again, there are different and competing notions of student outcomes, but the assumption is that there ought to be one standardized outcome. Levin again, the growth of interest, I think, yes, the growth of interest in evidence-based or evidence-informed decision-making in education is a salutary development. Those involved in research use must beware of losing their objectivity, of being seen to lose their objectivity, and of being used by other interests. When speaking as researchers or knowledge producers, there is, I believe, he writes, a requirement to be careful about the conclusions to be drawn from evidence, especially in the social sciences. To us, this and the entire article is very clear that Levin is still defending a certain notion of objectivity and neutrality in research. Notwithstanding the fact that he was deputy minister with the NDP government in Manitoba and now recently deputy minister with the Ontario Ministry of Education. Brink, again, evidence-based policy enables strategic and effective policy decisions for complex, multiple and persistent problems based on reliable research evidence. Its functions are to contribute to the policy debate based on evidence rather than ideology or tradition. As if there is data or evidence which is never ideologically based. But that's the assumption that goes with EBE. And these are the people who are determining the policies, in this case in Ontario, and the federal policies in Ottawa. Leetwood and others, again, people do not want education to continue being a political football. They want education policy to be based on pragmatic. Of course, who's pragmatics, right? Evidence-based approaches that will help all children achieve their highest potentials. And you see what is happening here. They make claims to all children achieve the highest potential. Who wants to deny all children achieving? Who wants to deny highest potential? But the question becomes on what basis and whose notion of achievement and potential. He wants a pragmatic one, not a philosophical one. He wants one which is evidence-based, which is not political and hence neutral and objective and so on. And finally, from a federal report to OECD, not just do the Canadian Policymakers want to influence policy in Canada, but even internationally. The research program consists of analysis of data from national surveys and longitudinal surveys, community-based case studies, laboratory simulations, randomized controlled experiments, and program evaluation. So they give us the sense here that a multiple of research methods are used. But wait a minute. All of them involve systematic procedures, tests of statistical significance, and peer review. Though there may be limitations to each method in the toolkit, multiple lines of evidence are used to build the case for policy. And then, Canada relies on a system of national surveys covering learning from birth to late adulthood. These surveys provide the data for the bulk of the research supporting policy. So first, there is a claim to a multiple way of doing things in research, but ultimately, what determines the bulk is the surveys. And then, of course, there was an entire book edited in 2001 arguing for the need for evidence-based research in Canada, and the editors claim, in part, some controversy exists because there has been a move in recent years to more rigorous empirical analysis with a focus on measuring causality. And this emphasis is evident throughout the volume. And again, that measuring causality, what they have in mind is the linear one-to-one causality that Carmen referred to earlier, that connects with logical positivist epistemology. So that is the Canadian context, or some examples. There are more. We've analyzed 150 texts. Some of our concluding remarks. All right, concluding remarks. There are major similarities between Canadian and other contexts. I hope the point has been well established. There are some differences. Although the Canadian literature has adopted the same terminology of EBE, proponents are less explicit, or seem to be less explicit, hence in a way more dangerous, about their theoretical and ideological stances. And we wonder, is this an expression of Canadian liberalism? Which in my view is very dangerous. There is, in the entire literature, only one, till last year, one Canadian critic so far. This is John Lewilinsky from the University of British Columbia. There has been no public dialogue in academic circles about EBE. It seems to be assumed or taken for granted, lock, stock, and barrel. And the question for us becomes, how do we develop a more inclusive education and research infrastructure in Canada that privileges different ways of knowing? And there are different ways of knowing. Those of us who do research in literacy know there are different forms of literacies. There are different forms of research, but these different forms are not accounted for by EBE. Within critical educational circles, we tend to fall into the trap of othering those with whom we disagree. Did I other Leetwood, Levin, Earle, and the rest by critiquing them? And by distinguishing between their soft liberalism and my critical democracy, perhaps I have. Well, then how do we get out of this issue of not othering? Is this impossible? Irrespective of that, we need to have an open and thorough discussion, and this is not always easy to achieve. We are not contending that there is no room for empirical evidence. However, a robust notion of equity implies a richer notion of evidence, one that seriously and genuinely incorporates other aspects or conceptions of evidence. Without such a perspective, will philosophical, spiritual, and ethical issues be included in constructing a worthwhile notion of evidence? Who and what will be marginalized when narrow notions of evidence are normalized? Will this really be a salutary development, as Levin contends? Which and whose notions of success will be privileged? Will responsible and philosophically divergent views held by teachers, oh, there is a mistake there, and school administrators be considered as acts of insubordination? There was another one which I missed. Two concluding paragraphs. Although at face value, EBE movement seems to be reasonable in its insistence on evidence, when one analyzes its underlying assumptions and its view about what counts as evidence, it follows that its very nature is limiting and implicitly marginalizes the recognition of knowledge and evidence that does not match up with its own assumptions. While EBE is presented as an ideal way of proceeding, if one adheres to a robust notion of democracy and equity, the inequities EBE reproduces through its promotion of the normalization of evidence make EBE a very dangerous slogan indeed. The call for substantive reforms hailed by the supporters of EBE in fact simply amount to a reproduction of current inequities, albeit through a different discourse which maintains the same neoliberal agenda and ideology. The overemphasis on the technicism associated with EBE and its underlying positivism and neoliberal ideology diverts attention from substantive and deeply rooted structural issues and causes of student failure, systemic racial and social class inequities, for example. A classic manifestation of this insidious phenomenon is the emphasis on standardized testing and narrow implementation of zero tolerance policies. The implementation of these policies, in North America at least, has involved millions of dollars without achieving their purported aims. Dropout rates have increased and violence in schools has not decreased. Imagine the possibilities of school improvement that could have been created if such funds, millions and millions of funds, were given to schools to utilize as they see fit, rather than spending all that money in standardized tests. Ultimately, EBE is yet another expression of the belief of standardization. Yet, a liberal democracy that does not recognize the need for a variety of standards, yet possibly equally plausible standards to operate at the same time, is a bankrupt democracy. Thank you.
Thank you, John, for your presentation. I think we have some time for a few questions.
I keep asking myself, what is EBE in Canada a reaction to? Because whenever you have someone who is saying, we need to be objective, etc., this person probably is coming from the experience of being unsatisfied with XYZ. And I'm saying this because in our context, we have lived through a number of, let's charity because of educational initiatives that would not be researched, that would not be funded, that would be refunded. We are now going through an enormous expense in terms of IT, etc., without anyone knowing if the first round of expense really made a difference, to what extent the difference, how it made a difference.
Sure.
So in that context, I would be the first one to say, can you please have evidence as to what happened to see if the next round of funding is necessary or not? So when I'm saying that within this context of dissatisfaction, that rightly or wrongly or badly or well, some kind of attempt at evaluation has happened, or has not, because it hasn't. So in my context, and with that history, you know, that is not bad. That is, you know, I mean, it's better than what we have. So if I say, let's do what works, especially in a context where we have tried to be PC in our educational administration or in the way we try to bring about reform, and it has been failed miserably, especially when we try to be PC. So my reaction would be, not obviously to be fascistic or dictatorial, but let us primarily see what works. It keeps coming to me. And I don't feel that when I say that, because of the history I have in mind, I don't feel I am necessarily being a rightist when I say that.
Okay, 2 points again, at least. First, a point about the Canadian context, and then a point about the notion of what works. Most of the authors I refer to, the Canadian authors I refer to, were in one way or another reacting to the excessive conservatism in education in Canada that took place in the 90s, right? There was a conservative provincial government in Ontario in the 90s, the same in British Columbia, the same in Alberta, the same in Nova Scotia, and so on. So there was this, even under liberal governments in other places in Canada, there was this move towards conservative educational policies. Okay. Most of these authors are associated with liberalism, and of course they were quite unhappy with those progressive conservative policies. The claim is that progressive conservative governments adopted educational policies not on the basis of evidence, but on the basis of ideology, right? And hence, the claim by these authors that we need to have more evidence-based education, right? As I said earlier, my argument is not against evidence, but the question of what amounts to evidence, whose evidence, and so on and so forth, right? And I don't deny that under the progressive conservative governments, almost fascist policies were adopted, at least in Ontario, and there were massive demonstrations by teachers, parents, and so on, to no avail, unfortunately. Okay? And we are still suffering in Ontario from Bill 160, which was adopted in 1997 or 1996. It's a very complicated bill. It actually changed the whole scene of education and education policy in Ontario. It's standardized, it's centralized, it created dichotomies between administrators and teachers, all sorts of issues. The interesting thing is that the liberal response, right, which was supposed to be one based of evidence, on evidence, has unfortunately adopted similar policies, unfortunately. So, for example, recently in Ontario and in other provinces in Canada, there has been this debate about faith-based schools, right? And the issue of having black-focused schools, that is, schools run on the basis of Afrocentric ideals and values. All right. With regard to the faith-based schools, which in my view is a very important issue that needs to be openly discussed, one of the authors that I refer to, Ken Leetwood, who is an EBE promoter, publicly said in an article in the Toronto Star that this whole discussion about faith-based schools is, within quotes, a distraction towards excellence in education. See, this is once again an indication of the kind of values and ideology that is associated by those who defend EBE, right? With regard to black-focused schools, notwithstanding the fact that for the last 50 years at least, sociologists of education internationally have shown us very massive evidence, shown us that there are strong connections between social class and race, for example, and lack of success in schools. The Premier of Ontario, quote, has big anxieties with regard to establishing black-focused schools. Why? There is massive evidence to show us that there are many black youths in Ontario who are marginalized and unsuccessful. The majority of the dropout rates in Ontario are from black youths and Portuguese youth. So why is the Premier, given this massive evidence, having anxieties and allowing 2, 3, 4 alternative schools based on Afrocentric beliefs? Beliefs of, let us say, we need a whole village to raise a child, based on spirituality, based on communal values, right? So while these EBE proponents were responding, and I think rightfully so, to the lack of concern for research and evidence that was promoted by the conservative governments, unfortunately, the same is being done by the same liberal governments, which shows us that this whole move towards EBE, in fact, is not neutral. It is itself ideologically based. And this is a claim, and I think it has demonstrated by critical educators for a very long time. Secondly, the point about what works. This is the whole issue all now that Leetwood himself said we need to take a pragmatic stance. All right. As an administrator myself in the university, I know that there are times when I have to decide and decide quickly or else possibilities are lost. And I do those decisions in good faith. Right? And if I make a mistake, I openly tell my colleagues that I had limited time, I had limited information, and yet I had to make a decision, and I'm willing to review and revise. Right? The question with what works is, the problem with what works is that it assumes, well, something may work for you, Sandro, and something may, the same thing may not work for me, simply because we may have different aims. If my aim in a class, for example, is to develop the poetics and the dialogue and the literacy, and if a colleague of mine is only interested in developing linear, westernized mode of writing, then of course what works for me is not going to work for my colleague next door. Not because we are doing inappropriate things, but because our aims are different. Right? So the issue of what works, if the assumption is that there is only one thing that needs to be identified, that works for all of us, if that is the assumption, then I'm afraid to say we have fallen back into the problem of one size fits all. And we know from experience that one size fits all does not lead to equity. One size fits all, by definition, marginalizes certain values and marginalizes certain people. So, my dilemma is, of course, wanting to be a fair administrator, a fair educator, is to consider, of course, the practical aspects, which I cannot not take into account, because that is part and parcel of my own profession as a teacher or administrator. But at the same time, accepting the crucible of ethics, epistemology, and philosophy.
Thank you, John, for being with us. Thank you for your presentation, and thank you all for coming. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the JMER in collaboration with the Department of Youth and Community Studies, entitled The Slogan of Evidence-Based Policy Practice Education in Canada, Whom Does It Serve? This talk was delivered by Professor John Portelli from the University of Toronto in Canada.